So here we, what we're going to do now is we're going to learn together from the Masechet, from the tractate called Beitza, which in English means egg, okay? And the tractate focuses on the laws of Yom Tov. So what it does is it basically, in the order of tractates, the Talmud develops and focuses on the laws of Shabbos and things related to that. So it'll go, let me show you just so you can see, give you a little visual here. One second here, let's look at Talmud. You see, like, it goes Shabbat Erevin, and then it does Pesachim Rosh Hashanah Yuma, which Pesachim is obviously, well, not obviously, but Pesachim is Passover related. Rosh Hashanah is related more to the cycles of the year, lunar and things of that nature, and also Rosh Hashanah related a little bit. Yoma is about Yom Kippur, and Sukkah speaks for itself. And then we get to Beitza, and Beitza is focused on the laws pertaining to Yom Tov in general. Like, how does that all work? And so, one of the things that you probably have heard of, have you ever heard of the term muktzah?
I've heard of the term muktzah, I don't know what it means.
Okay. So, muktzah, that term, you'll hear it in relation to Shabbos, and you'll hear it also related to Yom Tov, because basically, when it comes to Shabbos and Yom Tov, so when we say Yom Tov, so we're saying, let's say, Passover, the first day, first days, and Sukkot, Shavuot, that holiday, those three holidays, and then also Rosh Hashanah, we'll have, the laws will be similar to Shabbos, but there's one major thing that jumps out, specifically also to, well, exactly all to the four that I just listed, and that is ochel nefesh, right? That a person can do, can actually do malacha, we call it in Hebrew, but acts that are creative in nature that you wouldn't be allowed to do on Shabbos, related to preparing food. So anything that's around, related to preparing food, up to a certain extent, we'll see what that means, certain parameters, you're allowed now to do. So like cooking, you're allowed all of a sudden cook on Yom Tov, which you can't do on Shabbos. And any type of
preparation. Can you turn on the stove to cook on Yom Tov?
So the answer is, you would do so. If you have a way of starting the stove without, if you have an existing fire, so that's the idea, is that you take the existing fire and you start. You could start your stove that way, as long as you don't, like, let's say today's technology. So, like, if you have a starter, if you can circumvent that starter, or the electrical starter, by let's say you have an existing light, you strike a match, you put it next to the gas, and boom, it turns on. So then you can cook. No problem.
You can't strike a match.
You can't strike the match, but if you have an existing fire, you just
have a candle burning, or something else.
Okay. So we'll see. But the most simple, most basic level, the idea of food prep, that's all of a sudden allowed. Sarach ochal nefesh, we call it, for the need for ochal nefesh. Now, for food, for eating. Now, what's interesting is, then they might extend, and this is part of the discussion, is how can you take that principle, how far can it be extended? Can you say, well, that act, for example, you know, once I have an existing fire, can I use the fire for other things besides food preparation? Meaning, once I say that I can do this act for the food prep, can I do that act, that same act, for other things that don't necessarily relate to food preparation? Okay, so we have to see that. Now, one of the things that you have by Shabbos, this idea of muktzah, so what muktzah basically says, and there's different parameters to this as well, this is, you know, much more extended and involved, but the basic idea is that when it comes to Friday afternoon, as the sun is setting, as the sun sets, was that item set aside for usage for the next 24, 25 hours. And if it wasn't, then perhaps we'll say that since at the time of we call it Bein HaShemasha, it basically means between the time of the sunset, when the sun goes under the horizon, and nightfall, that's that middle period we call dusk. Dusk, right? Is that dusk? So that time period, which is kind of like this intermediary period between the end of the day and the beginning of the night, right? So you have that kind of, we call it Bein HaShemasha, between the suns, okay? So that in that period of time, what that kind of becomes the defining moment of the next 24, 25 hours. So, right, so what the status of something, you know, whether So there are two ways of looking at it. Do I need to actively say, I'm going to want to use this thing going forward? Or is it more to the other way of saying, as long as I didn't say that I'm going to use this? Meaning, if I take something that and I put it in a position where I say, I don't, or by act alone, it shows that I don't want to have any use of this item for the next X amount of, you know, the full day. So therefore, it's set aside now, and I can't use it. So what it just came up today in the Daf, further on in Beitza, on the 26th page, it already talks about the idea of where you want to dry something out. Let's say you want to take grapes and make them into you put them on your roof. You want to dry them out. So you're showing by my putting that up on my roof in the sun, I'm saying I don't want this for the next, I don't know how many days, but clearly over the next 24 hours, I don't want to use this thing. So that's like an act of where I'm actively saying, I don't want to use this. The flip side could be, I could say, I'm not sure. You know, it's not clear. At that time, when the onset of the upcoming holy day, you know, it can go either way. Okay, but there's this idea in general of, does something need to be set aside or designated from the beginning of that 24-hour period of this is going to be something I want to use or not use. Like we have to figure this all out, okay? So now, this Mishnah here,
Is that what Muksa is? So you started off defining Muksa.
Right, so that would be, so that's one, well, that's one example of Muksa, okay?
I thought it was something you can't use on Shabbat.
Like, correct, right. So now there are other things, like for example, let's say a tool. Let's say I have a hammer, and I use that hammer for work, right? Creative work. So therefore, that's a different type of muksa that says this item is used for specific work that I can't do on Shabbos. So now this thing becomes muksa, but that's muksa because of a different reason. That's because I use it for things that are not permitted, right? There could be things that I could say I'm not going to use it because it's disgusting. Like, so I don't want to, you know. So that's where we'll see how muksa becomes like more of an expanded type of thing. But, you know, as we get to Yom Tov, in this specific thing, because Yom Tov already has this different wrinkle, and that is the Sorach Ochal Nefesh, like for the purposes of eating. So then, like, if you would think on the surface that a lot more should be okay. So we have to see exactly... do I have to actively do something in order for it to be permitted going into the day? Like, do I have to say, I'm setting this aside because I want to use this? Do I have to do that kind of thing? Do I have to prepare it? Do more preparation work for something to set it aside so that now I know it's okay? Or maybe not. Or maybe, you know, it's not clear, you know? So we'll see. This is all like preparatory to getting into this subject matter, and this is we call it a sugya. It's like it's an entire like scope of learning that you start slowly, you start seeing it. Like here, it's a very cryptic Mishnah, because again, the way the Mishnah works is the Mishnah basically was taking an oral tradition that came from Sinai that was developed like parallel to the written Torah, and then at a certain point, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi felt that it needed to be formalized and written down into like a very set order. And that's what we call the Mishnah. And so that you had Mishnayot, which were taking the oral tradition and then making almost like a cryptic note, that said, okay, here's what we're going to start, kind of in a certain sense, a soft codification of the work. And then the Talmud came along, and these are over like 400 or 500 year period. So the end of the Mishnaic period was Rabbi Yehuda coming, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the prince, and he codified, in a sense, he wrote the Mishnah, right? So like Pirkei Avot is one of many Mishnayot that became part of the greater six orders of the Mishnah. And then after that, because it was so cryptic, that you needed the Talmud to come and kind of open it up and try to understand what exactly did Rabbi Yehuda put here into this work called the Mishnah. And so when you open up a Talmud, you're opening up a Mishnah followed by the Talmud. And then on top of that, you'll have later people like Rashi, and Rashi will give us an explanation, just trying to help us understand what's going on in the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Talmud. And then on top of that, you'll have Tosfot, which are like, again, two generations later of Rashi's grandsons, maybe some others, different schools called the Tosafists that are also looking at certain things. They'll focus on Rashi. They'll look at also how do we understand the Talmudic text. So it's like an ongoing, and then you have others, not necessarily in the Talmudic book, but others like Maimonides who are codifying and others that are coming to explain. In the codifications, you'll start getting a sense of how they understood. How do you read a Mishnah? How do you read the Talmud? So it's a lot of fun. And then in the process, there's all this analytics that's going on and different approaches as to the subject that we have here, which we'll see in a second. So now so on the surface, we're going to read the Mishnah. We're going to say, what does it have to do with anything? And then you're going to see in the Talmud, as it tries to pick it apart and try to understand the Mishnah, that in the process, you'll start to see a very interesting picture in terms of trying to understand how exactly we understand this whole mitzvah, or how does this whole mechanism of on Yom Tov about our approach to what's allowed to be used, what can't be used, and things of that nature. And then whether it's of biblical, is it a biblical directive that's driving it, or is it more rabbinic in nature? We'll have to see how that develops. Okay, so let's just look at this Mishnah. We'll start with that. Okay, so you see it in front here. Okay, so it says like this. Beitza shenolda b'yom tov, with regard to an egg that was laid on a festival. Okay, so now the question is that permitted or not? So Beit Shammai say it may be eaten even on that day, and Beit Hillel says it may not be eaten. Okay, and so the Gemara will have to get explained why exactly does Beit Shammai say you can eat it? Why does Beit Hillel say you can't? Then the Mishnah goes on and says another case. It says, and I'm jumping. I'm not even looking at this. I'm just jumping to where it's bolded, right? So Beit Shammai says leaven. So something that can become leavened, seor, dough that was leavened to such an extent that it is no longer used as food, but as a leavening agent for other dough, is prohibited on the Passover in the measure of an olive bulk, right? So seor b'kizayit, v'chametz b'kikosevet. Whereas leavened bread itself, of a large date bulk. So the size, so according to Beit Shammai, the size of the leavening agent is smaller for it to be a problem, and for something that's not as strongly leavened, so the bread itself, that is a larger size in order to be held responsible on Passover. Okay. By the way, this line, this thing about the leaven, completely doesn't fit in here. It's like a very strange thing why the Mishnah is throwing this in. It doesn't seem to relate to this. Here you have the story. The first thing about whether or not you can use an egg that was laid on Yom Tov itself. Then you have this case of leaven, a leavening agent as opposed to the bread itself, the chametz itself. Beit Hillel says it's just a matter of the olive bulk, okay? And then the third case is one who slaughters an undomesticated animal or a bird on a festival. Okay? So whether or not, how do you play that game? Mm. Now when I say play that game, chay and oaf, an undomesticated animal and a bird, when you do a slaughter, when you slaughter them ritually, you have to cover their blood. And you do it with usually with dirt, or it could be some or ash. Something has to, you have to cover. You have a mitzvah to cover the blood. So now, what's the story? How would we approach doing slaughtering of that type of animal when it comes to Yom Tov? Now again.
Why would you be slaughtering an animal on Yom Tov?
Okay, so if we say that you're allowed to do things for food preparation.
Oh.
So that, but it's a good question. Meaning, so what ends up coming out, just as like to cut like down, like just a little bit of. Just a little bit, is that when it comes to that, like today, for example, you don't need to slaughter an animal to get fresh meat, you know, that day. Like I can go out, go to the market, buy a piece of meat, put it in the freezer and pull it out, and it's going to be just as fresh, I think, as if I got it straight out of the slaughtering house. Okay? Meaning, we're going to say, basically, that it's true that you can do all actions that are necessary to have food on a Yom Tov, but the principle that's laid out is that if you can do some of that work prior to Yom Tov, so then we're going to say to you, you know what? How about you do all that extra work before the holiday and not rely on doing it on the holiday itself? Unless you come and argue with me and say there are certain things that are only good if you do it fresh, meaning like in the moment.
You shouldn't be digging the potato out of the ground to have potatoes on Yom Tov.
Correct.
You shouldn't be doing it that morning.
Unless you can give me, and the argument would be, unless you could tell me that there's a noticeable difference when you pull it straight out of the ground as opposed to getting it, you know, 2 days, you know, ago at ShopRite, and it's like you're getting a potato, it's a potato, it's a potato. There's no difference between that potato that I bought 3 days ago at the market and the one I'm pulling out of the ground right now. Okay, so if you tell me there's a noticeable difference, maybe then you can argue that, hey, yeah, for the purposes of enjoying the Yom Tov meal, then that
therefore, so picking a tomato off the vine might actually be much more flavorful than one you picked 2 days ago.
Correct, something like that. But again, you know, within reason, right? We're going to say, we'll get there. There's what to talk about there, okay? But it's going to be a while till we get to that point.
I just want to understand why there's a question about the egg, but okay.
Oh, no. So that's, we're going to get to that, because when we really get down to the nitty gritty, it's going to take us some time to get there. When we finally get to the point of what's really happening here, it's amazing. It's really unbelievable. Meaning, when Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, when he put this mission together, he codified, and he's putting some ideas that are so deep that as we try to like parse it and put it together, it becomes it becomes amazing to see how, you know, what exactly is being said here. Okay, it's like it's really coded. Okay, so we need to kind of decode this thing. Okay, so we're starting. This is like step by step. Okay, so this case of slaughtering a wild, an undomesticated animal or bird, there is this idea that in those two cases, when you do slaughter, you have to cover the blood. So now the question is, if that's required, so you're saying to me now that you're going to have to do certain things like digging, which really not allowed to do on a Yom Tov normally. Okay, so if it's prepared beforehand, maybe if you prepared it beforehand so your dirt is all ready to rock and roll, so then the slaughtering would be okay, you know, because anything that would be required post the slaughter is already ready to go, so maybe that's not an issue. So let's just see the case. We're going to end up coming back to this later. It's not, we're going to get back more into the Gemara. The Talmud's going to really start first things first with the egg, so we're going to get back to it. So just to finish off this Mishnah, so in regards to the slaughtering of an undomesticated animal or bird on a festival, so Beit Shammai say he digs earth with a shovel and covers the blood with the earth. Okay? Ab initio. Initio. Okay, so we'll see exactly what's going on there. And Beit Hillel said he may not slaughter, right? He cannot accept unless he had earth prepared for that purpose while it was still day. So if he had prepared the earth before the you know, sundown, so then that might be a different story. But even Behil concede that if one already slaughtered the animal or the bird, then he should dig with a shovel and cover the blood. So it's like almost like we have this idea of, we call it lechatchila b'dieved. Can you, are you allowed to do the slaughtering? Well, really, you shouldn't. But if you already did, then here's what you would say. So Beit Hillel is saying, not so clear cut, you can slaughter. But if you already did the slaughtering, so then this is how you have to deal with that. And then additionally, they agree that the ashes of a stove are considered prepared for the use of covering blood, as will be explained by the Gemara. So there are two things that, just when we read a Mishnah, in terms of the flow, the second case here of where Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are arguing about what is the minimum amount for Passover and something that's considered to be chametz, it really doesn't seem to belong here. So we have to figure out what that's doing here. And then this last line also is kind of like, what is it even talking about? This idea of additionally, ash of a stove is considered prepared. It's like, where did that come from? Like, it's like very strange. Something's not, we're missing a line or something. But either way, so that's the Mishnah. We're going to, one of those things with the Mishnah, is like you can read it multiple times. It's it's so cryptic. There's so much that's not being said. But we'll take the Talmud will help us, guide us to try to kind of, again, decode what's going on here. So now, first things first. When we talked about the egg that was laid on a festival, okay? So, the Gemara asks, with what case are we dealing in this Mishnah? Now, what do you mean? So now, Talmud will tell us. What is the status of the mother? Okay?
Laid the egg?
Yeah, exactly. Because why? If we say that the Mishnah is referring to a chicken that is designated for eating, i.e. one planned to slaughter and eat a chicken that laid an egg, so then what is the reason that Beit Hillel prohibit eating the egg? It is food that has been separated, meaning the egg is an extension of the mother. So if at the time of the sundown, here you have a chicken that is set aside for food. So if it has an egg inside, that's also an extension food at sundown. So then if the entire chicken is considered food as it is designated for eating, and this egg is simply a part of that, became detached, just as one may partake of the chicken itself on a festival, its egg should likewise be fit for consumption. Right? So if you're saying chicken equals food, egg equals food. When? At that critical time as the sun is setting and we define these things, is this food or is it not food? If it's food, so then why, if the egg is laid, why would Beit Hillel say you can't eat it? Okay? So, therefore, rather, the Mishnah must be referring to the case of a chicken designated for laying eggs. So it's not considered to be food. The chicken itself is not food. So now this egg, since the owner of this chicken decided not to eat it on the festival, meaning the chicken, it is classified as set aside.
Oh, mutzah.
And mutzah items may not even be moved, let alone eaten. Since the chicken itself is mukzah, its egg is mukzah as well. Okay, meaning it's no, this is not, here you have a chicken, it's not meant for food, so then everything that's in it, i.e. its egg, also is not meant. It's really not, it's off limits at sundown, it's no longer, it's not in, designated for use. So then the question...
Not to throw a wrench in here, why can't you designate, the chicken is designated as a vehicle for laying eggs, right?
Okay.
So why can't you designate the eggs that come out of the chicken as food?
I'll tell you what I was just thinking.
The chicken is the vehicle, right?
Hold on. No, so we'll see. Let's see. The reason I was thinking there is let's see. Let's the Gemara will. We'll talk about that a little bit. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So. Sorry, okay. It's not. It's not. No. No. It's a good question. It's a very good, excellent question. Okay. So now, now if you're going to say though that this is a egg producer as opposed to a food, so then the question is why would Beit Shammai then say that you're okay with this? The Gemara asks, if so, what is the reason of Beit Shammai for permitting one to eat the egg? After all, it's muktzah. So the Gemara expresses surprise at this question, and what is the difficulty? Perhaps Beit Shammai do not hold that there is a prohibition of muktzah. Ooh. Okay, so now we have to take a step back. So we say time out on the field, okay? And we say, wait a second, what do you mean there's no muktzah? So let's see, this is interesting. There is a machloka, there is a difference of opinion between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda as to whether there is such a thing as muktzah at all. So here he says in this little note here, there are different opinions with regard to the scope of the prohibition of muktzah. It is possible that Beit Shammai, like other Tanaim, people of the Mishnah, maintain that there is no prohibition of this type of muktzah. Perhaps this is the subject of the dispute with Beit Hillel. So maybe we're just talking about straight up muktzah. That what we're so again. So you see what the Gemara did here. The Gemara said, "What are we talking about in terms of this chicken? What's the status of the chicken? Is the chicken something that's prepared as food?" It's like there used to be a cartoon where like the thing would look at, I forgot what it was, it would look at something and like, he saw it in his mind, he was like saw it as food. It was like a chicken and he saw it already like prepared on the table. Like, I don't know, you ever see that like little like cartoon where he would look at the, he already saw, he visualized the chicken already like being, like served as food, whatever it is. So, right, so the Gemara's saying, is it talking food here? No. It's not talking food, it's talking egg producer. You want to say maybe you could already designate this as the whatever eggs to come are going to be this something that kind of makes a reference to something like that. We'll have to see. But in the context of this, we say I muktzah. So the Gemara then answers maybe there's no, maybe according to Beit Shammai, who says you can eat this thing, this egg that was produced, that was laid on Yom Tov, is that he doesn't hold of muktzah to any at all, meaning that he's going to say, you don't need to go through this whole thing of like setting something aside, okay? So let's see what the Gemara says here. Before stating its proposed solutions for this difficulty, the Gemara notes, it enters our mind to say that even one who permits moving an item that was set aside by its owners on a festival or Shabbat prohibits the owners from doing so with an object that came into being on a festival. Okay, so now here we go. Here's another one. You ready for this one? There's muktzah. That we talked about, the idea of setting something aside as the holiday or Shabbos is starting. Okay? What about something that did not exist at that time? So we call something like that nolad, which means Friday afternoon, the eve of the Yom Tov, the thing didn't exist. It only came into being during the holiday or during Shabbos itself. We call that nolad. Nolad means it was born. It wasn't there until midday, mid-holiday, mid-Shabbos. So at the time of sunset, that defining moment didn't exist. So he's saying like this, even if you say, the guy who says muktzah is not an issue, meaning, I don't have a requirement. There are people of the opinion that say, comes the sunset period, which is the defining period. I don't hold with that. I don't agree with the idea that something needs to be set aside at that time of, you know, as the, on the onset of the holiday or Shabbos. But there's another idea that would say, okay, great. I don't think that that's an issue, but what about something that didn't exist at that moment in time? Let's say it only came in.
No, that's got to be off.
So you want to say, right? It should be a no-go, right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's. So that. So
now,
he says.
Hold on a second. This is going to get into some very serious stuff in relation to other things that have nothing to do with food.
Okay.
Because if you're saying that an egg didn't exist in the womb of the chicken prior to Shabbos, you're opening a whole door for a whole discussion about abortion rights, things like that. You're talking about existence, correct?
Well, no, no. So, no.
We don't need to get into that.
No. No. We're not going there. We're not going there. But even.
No, I understand.
No, but even though it's interesting. What's interesting, what you just said, though, that could be, even within the context of the egg, right? Because eggs don't just, like, you know, materialize. Correct. So there's a good chance that that egg is already. Well, we have to see. We have to figure out what the story with the egg is. I mean, in terms of like that whole process. But right now, let's just say like this.
We'll stick with this. All right.
Okay. So see, right.
You're talking about existence.
Okay, but so after. Right away. So far, but let's. So what do we have here? So we're saying now is that you could have afilu man dashari muksa, even if you say that there's no such thing as muksa, but there's also this other thing called nolad, which means basically that something that didn't exist at the defining moment of, you know, the day coming into, you know, that as the day is beginning, again, sunset defines the beginning of that of the Shabbos or Yom Tov period. But maybe they'll say that Nola could be an issue, that the idea of something coming into existence at a later point within the 24-25 hour period, that's gonna be an issue. So now, according to that, my tamay de Beis Shammai. So even if you're gonna say that Beis Shammai does not hold of Muktza, but this case of the egg being laid, he would. I mean, how could you ever say that that was prepared? I mean, there's this need to be. So we're going with this. There's something in that's behind this. There's something behind the. You know, like we're assuming here that we know, is that at least it has to be in existence or something like that. There's something like needs to be there in order for it to become okay. Or I don't know. Like it seems to be when we say this idea that nolad is a problem, that right, something that comes that's only, you know, coming to existence. That a little bit into the day that you
it
know
has to be off limits.
Correct. But why do you say that?
Because if the idea is to plan in advance of that which you can use on the Yom Tov,
good. So you're saying, right? So something that has to have advanced prep, right? We said that earlier, right?
Right. For example, like what isn't like the blast kind of sort of like that, like the, you know, the heat source, for example, like on Shabbat, don't you have like a little heat thing, like a
right.
And so you've planned in advance that that's going to be, you know, prepped and done before the start of the Yom Tov. And so it would make sense that anything that comes into existence during the Yom Tov that you didn't plan for has to be off limits.
Interesting. I never thought of the blech like being some part of the operation of the prep, but it could be some kind of subtle requirement. It's not so crazy. It's an interesting idea. Like I would have to think about it. Like if that.
But think. Okay, maybe that's not a good example. Think about like there, like your Shabbos lights. You know that these lights are going to be on, and I'm going to turn them on Friday afternoon before sunset, so I know that I can use them on Friday night. So that's you've prepped for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that comes into existence during that 25-hour period, whatever it is, has to be, to me, it has to be off limits.
It's interesting. Again, so this is you're touching on, like, these are big ideas that we have to, like, figure out, like, do we have the, we need to, so what we're doing here now, by the way, the process of what we're doing is we're working through these ideas to basically figure out what is the line, how does this muktza thing work, how does nolad work, how do all these things work in terms of, and there's also something called hachana, which you're referencing, the idea of preparing, how does that work? Like, what kind of prep is necessary or unnecessary? Let's just say it that way, okay? So now, let's go on in the Gemara.
Let's move on. I have a thing about, you're talking about it coming to existence, but we're also talking about setting something aside. And you know when your chickens are going to lay eggs.
Okay. Well, again, let's move on to this. There's more. We're just laying out the basics right now. Okay. Let's see what it says. So again, the challenge, just it's always important when you're going through Gemara to like just keep in mind, like I keep
don't
the
much at all.
No, I just keep on like there's we're running through like we're doing a logical plane, but to keep like the major header in our mind's eye, just to remember like what we're trying to figure out. What are we trying to answer? Right. And what we're trying to answer, just as again, I always go back to keep the picture clear, is that we have this question about the egg being laid on the festival where Beis Shammai says you can eat it, okay? And Beit Hillel says you can't eat it. Okay, so we're trying to understand why at this point we're saying that this is talking about a case of where it was a chicken that's not for eating but rather for laying eggs. And even if you say that he doesn't think muktzah is an issue, but nolad, something that is coming into existence post, like once we're into the day itself, so that seems to, that should be an issue. Why does Beit Shammai say it's okay to eat? Okay, so here comes the, okay, so now we have the first attempt to really explain it is Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says, actually, the Mishnah is referring to a chicken designated for laying eggs, okay. However, our previous assumption was mistaken. As the sage who holds that there is a prohibition of muktzah in general also holds that there is a prohibition of objects that came into being, while one who does not hold that there is a prohibition of muktzah likewise does not hold that there is a prohibition of objects that came into being. Again, I'll say it in simple English. Basically saying is, you know what, how it works? It works like this. Actually, if you don't believe that there's an issue of muktzah, you'll also say there's no issue of nolad as well. Meaning that the same way that I say it's not a problem to have not designated something at sunset, muktzah, so too that same person believes that there's no problem if something ends up coming into existence within the middle of Yom Tov or Shabbos. So he's going to say basically the same guy who says no muktzah, no nolad. And, right, so therefore, Beis Shammai will go with the opinion, which is Rabbi Shimon, who holds. So consequently, the dispute can be summed up as follows. Beis Shammai will hold in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, who maintains that there is no prohibition of muktzah or nolad. Again, the thing that comes into existence already in the middle of the day. Where Beis Hillel hold in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who rules that there is a prohibition of muktzah. Okay, so with that, what I would say, I would translate it in our what we're saying now is we start out by saying that seems to be this need to like prepare that in order to be able to use something on the holiday or Shabbos, you need to prepare it pre. But according to the one who says you don't. So then, what do I care if it's there or not there at the time of sunset? I have no need to do, there's no need for preparation. That's basically what it seems like he's saying. That this opinion of Rabbi Shimon, who Beis Shammai is going to hold like, at least what appears like now, he'll say, you don't need to prepare. There's no need for preparation. So I don't care if it's there or not there at sunset. It didn't need any preparation. Okay? It might be within Rabbi Shimon that he'll say something like this, that he'll say like, hey, you know when I have a problem? My problem will only be if I specifically go out of my way to say, I don't want to use this thing over this period of time. Then he'll say, you know what? You can't use that because you did something, you made an act that said, no, this is off limits, which is interesting. So in a sense, at least on the surface, Rabbi Shimon will say, my default setting is everything's a go, unless you went out of your way to say no. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda says, which is Beis Hillel, that says you can't eat this egg that was born on, which was laid on Yom Tov. He'll say no. You need. It seems to be a need. Well, there's something with muktzah. Meaning, if it was not prepared, if something's not prepared at sundown, then the thing that's born during the day, already into the period, he'll say, you know, it wasn't set aside at sundown, you know, something like that. Okay, fine. Now it's interesting. So the Gemara then has an issue with something a little bit on the side. because they have another case. Because so they ask the question. The Gemara is puzzled by the explanation. Did Rav Nachman actually say that Beit Hillel hold in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda? But didn't we learn it in Mishnah? So there's another case in Shabbos 143a. The case is you're eating your meal, and you have some pistachio, right? So you're eating your pistachios, and you drop the shells, or peanuts. You have the shells, or you're eating chicken, the bones. Now that you've finished eating and you have all those things there, are you allowed to move those off the table? Is that become something that's prohibited? Because it has no utility at this point. When it had utility, it was food that you wanted to eat, so you're eating your pistachios. But now that you're done, the shells are there, and there's no utility whatsoever, is that okay? Can you touch that? Is that now...
They're saying that the act clean is breaking Shabbos?
Well, again, meaning we're going to say like there are things that are allowed to be used and not used. If this has no utility, so then maybe it shouldn't be used. Meaning, once the shell.
You're not using it. You're just.
So can I move it? Can
you're
I?
Using the shell.
No. So I'm saying once. So like. So, the idea would be, like, when I have something that has need, like I have a reason to use it, has utility. So then it's okay. But once it loses its utility, I've eaten the item, so this is the leftover. Maybe the leftover is a problem in terms of muksa. Let's use that name, that thing. I mean, it's no longer, you know, again, it's lost its utility. Let's just say like that for now. Let's just read the case. So Beis Shammai say, one may remove bones and shells left from the meal, from the table, despite the fact that they are inedible and are muksa. Okay? They no longer are edible, no longer have utility. And by Shama, I say, it is prohibited to do so. Rather, one may remove the entire board, that is, the table surface, which is a vessel that may be carried, and shake it all at once. By moving the table, which is not muksa, one is able to shake off the bones and shells, but he may not move the items themselves. Okay? So, one saying, so what do we have here?
Come on.
What do you mean, come on?
I mean, come on, like, how is it, I don't know, it seems like you're really in the woods there, like.
Well, again, let's think about it. We're saying like this, what we're really saying is, on the surface, anything that has utility, that's okay. But if something has no utility or any, right, so then we're saying, okay, then you shouldn't be using that because we only try to use things that have an upside in usage. But if it really is garbage,
but how is it cleaning up after yourself using it?
Yeah. No. So wait. So again, I'll say it like this. I'll couch it like this. We'll say that we're going to define and say that you can that in general when it comes to Shabbos. We try to say to you, we'll try to limit and say, only use things that, only move things, only touch things that have a purpose for today. But by default,
right,
anything.
Okay.
I'll give an example. Like, yeah, so for example, let's give an example, like just a basic, simple example. Like, okay, so I have my food on the table that I didn't eat because there was extras, right? So we have chicken and all that extra, all the perishable items. So can you take those off the table and put them in the refrigerator? So the answer is, yeah, we don't want to, right? So you need to put that away, otherwise it spoils. You'll lose, you know, it's like you're going to, you don't, there's no, nothing to be, not, no positive thing of well, let's say I shouldn't even say it that way. It's like we're really looking at it and saying things that need to be done can be done, but if it's not necessary, you don't do it. Let's just say it that way for now. Okay, that's this one position.
How about this?
Yeah.
Here's another position. Sitting at a table with discarded scraps of food interferes, is like, it doesn't,
it's disgusting.
It alters the experience.
It's disgusting.
Shabbat.
Right, correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So there would be, okay, good. So that's
it's good. It's in the best interest it's in the best interest of everybody and myself to clean up after ourselves like any normal person would do, so that the experience can be more pleasurable.
Good, excellent. So that's that might be right. So that again, so there you're starting to build a reasoning as to why, even according to the one who would say in general, this doesn't seem to have any utility. But either so, but the flip side is you're saying, but it's disgusting, and so therefore, for having a respectable, you know, environment, and therefore that would be perhaps a reason to say that's grounds for removing this stuff.
Right.
Okay, good. So either way, so but now this is where you have to be careful. This is the trap. Trap is that we're just going off on a side tangent for a second here. Within our conversations, we got to get back to what we're focused on, which is again Beis Shammai Beis Hillel, about whether or not you can eat the egg that was laid on Yom Tov, right? And so Rav Nachman, the way he did it was, he said, it seems to be an issue of muktzah and the one and nolad, and that they go hand in hand, and that the one who says that you're allowed to eat this egg, it's because he is not of the opinion that there is such a thing as muktzah or nolad. And that's why it's okay. Beis Shammai says teyachal, you can eat it. But then they ask, is this Rav Nachman consistent? But we have another Mishnah that says that actually, he in that case of we have the shells on the table and you have the Beis Hillel Beis Shammai opinion there, and Rav Nachman said there that version of the Mishnah is not in accordance with the halacha. Rather, the opinions should be reversed. As we have nothing other than the following version of this dispute. Beit Shammai hold, in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who maintains that the prohibition of muktzah applies, while Beit Hillel hold, in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, who maintains that the halacha of muktzah does not apply. Why then does Rabbi Nachman explain that the ruling of Beit Hillel in the case of the egg is in the Mishnah is based on the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who holds that there actually is a prohibition of muktzah? So in a nutshell, no pun intended, but basically, what we're saying now is, there's a bad pun, I know. But basically, what we're saying now is, Rav Nachman came to explain our Mishnah that Beis Shammai said it's okay to eat that egg. He was of the opinion that there's no such thing as muktzah or nolad. But we have Rav Nachman in another case that explained the other way, that he flipped it around and said that Beis Shammai does not hold like Rabbi Shimon. Who hold, right? Because again, Rabbi Shimon is the one who says there's no muktzah. Rav Nachman explained our Mishnah as saying that Beis Shammai is like Rabbi Shimon that doesn't hold of muktzah or nolad. But in this other case in Shabbos, he seems to say the opposite. So the Gemara answers that Rav Nachman would have said to you in reply, with regard to Shabbos, this is the case where the Tana taught as an unattributed Mishnah, which is generally accepted as the halacha in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, as he learned in a Mishnah. One may cut pumpkins before an animal to facilitate their consumption. Likewise, one may cut up an animal carcass before dogs, even if the animal died on Shabbos, to enable them to consume it. Although the carcass is classified as muktzah, it may be moved on Shabbos. So look at this. What the Gemara is going to do here is he's going to say, I'm going to differentiate between Shabbos and Yom Tov, okay? And Rav Nachman there is saying one thing, it's a Shabbos case, and he's going to say something different in the case of Yom Tov. And here's what the Gemara is going to say. The Gemara concludes, because I'm going to jump over that case. We'll come back to that case of the carcass, etc. But let's just, for our purposes right now, to get the flow, the Gemara concludes that the unattributed Mishnah in Tractate Shabbat is in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shimon. For this reason, Rav Nachman establishes that the dispute between Rabbi Hillel and Beit Shammai should be understood to mean that Beit Hillel hold in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, whom the halacha apparently follows, as there is a principle that the halacha is always in accordance with Beit Hillel's opinion. So when we have a Beit Hillel-Beit Shammai disagreement, 9 out of 10 times, the halacha goes like Beit Hillel. It's like halacha is like Beit Hillel, across the board. However, with regard to a festival, the Tana taught as an unattributed Mishnah in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, as we learned in a Mishnah in this tractate, one may not chop wood on a festival from beams prepared for use in construction work, nor one may chop kindling wood from a beam that broke on a festival. Okay, so you can't do that. Why? As the beams were not prepared for this use when the festival began, they are classified as muktzah, right? They weren't prepared before, therefore muktzah. This demonstrates that an unattributed Mishnah prohibits muktzah on a festival. Consequently, so here we go. Rav Nachman establishes the opinion of Beit Hillel in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who prohibits muktzah. So in our case, Rav Nachman's going to say, the case of where the egg is laid on Yom Tov, Rav Nachman's going to say, Beit Hillel said, don't eat it, is going to go like Rabbi Yehuda says, that's a muktzah issue. He does so by asserting that the Mishnah is referring to the case of a chicken designated for laying eggs, which is muktzah. And therefore, that's how we lay it out. Right? It's going to be egg laid on Yom Tov. I'm going to hold like, it's going to be there's a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai says you can eat it. Beit Hillel says you can't. And it's going to be in accordance, like we said originally. This is a muktzah issue. When Beit Shammai says you can eat it, it's because he holds there's no such thing as muktzah, like Rabbi Shimon. And the Beit Hillel opinion of you can't eat it, it's because he holds it's a muktzah issue. Okay? And therefore, he holds like Rabbi Yehuda, who's more strict. So now, why is that the case? So here it goes. The Gemara asks, now since, consider the following. Who is the one who wrote and edited the Mishnah and arranged the unattributed Mishnayot? It was Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. Since the same sage formulated the statements in both tractates, the question arises, what is it different? What is different with regard to the halachot of Shabbat that he stated the unattributed opinion and ruled for us in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, who is going to be more lenient? And what is the different? And what is different with regard to the halachot of the festival that he stated the unattributed opinion and ruled for us in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda? Answers. They answer and say, in the case of Shabbat, which is stringent with regards to its punishments, and therefore people will not come to treat it with contempt, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi taught us the unattributed Mishnah in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, who rules leniently. Since people automatically are going to be geared up to take Shabbos a little more seriously, so they had room to be lenient when it came to the Shabbos case. Conversely, with regard to a festival which is lenient, as certain labors may be performed on a festival, like we talked about, and therefore people will be more likely to come to treat it with contempt, he stated the unattributed opinion for us in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who rules stringently. Okay? So what we have here is like if we're going to lay out this, if we're going to chart this case, and this is just, guys, just the beginning, and there's a lot of stuff that I just like flew through here that we have to come back to because there's a lot of subtlety going on here.
Oh, my God.
But on the most basic level, if I'm going to look at this thing, as we're going to explain it now, it's going to boil down to when that egg is laid on Yom Tov, we end up...
You can't touch it.
Oh, interesting. Is that true? Can you not touch it, or just can't eat it?
No, I mean.
No. It's interesting. By the way,
you can't eat it.
No, I want to show you something. You just said something very interesting. So look at this. Check this out. I just want to show you something. Let's see if I can show you this here. So Tosus is okay. I don't know in English. Okay, I'm going to translate a few. Tosas asked this question. In the case of where the egg is laid on Yom Tov, Beit Shammai says you can eat it, Beit Hillel says you can't eat it. The Imtomar, which is a question, and if you say, Amai lo tana asur nu mutarn, why does it say eat and don't eat? Why doesn't it say prohibited or permissible? Right? It just says you can eat it or you can't eat it. It should say, this is not permitted, this is permitted. You hear it? Why is he using the language of eating? You can eat or not eat it. It should just say, like many places, it will say, this is prohibited. You hear? Right? It says, may be eaten, may not be eaten. Should have said, this is prohibited or this is permissible. Yeah? So yeah. Tosas asked that question because he said, don't touch this. You're hitting Tosas's question because Tosas says, it should say, us or mutter, permitted or permissible or prohibited. So, because he said, v'chitema osrin mashma sha'asur la'olam. When you say something is prohibited, it means prohibited, meaning I can't even touch this, can't even carry it. If I say eat, not eat, it's a little bit different, right?
Can you look at it?
No, okay.
Hugh, you might have to get shmita soon.
Okay, so fine. Because he says here, Yeshlomer, di have tani asur matarin hayiti omer shemasha matirim habetsa hainu letaltel. Because it might be just talking about carrying it. That you could carry it and not carry it, but eating would be off limits anyway. So it's a whole, it's very interesting. See, you touched on something cute there. Okay. But here, exactly. See that? You're machaming to Tosas' question. Unbelievable.
My soul is guiding me.
Okay, so right now, for where we're at right now, because we're just starting to scratch the surface of this, okay? So this is where we're going to summarize it for right now. What we did, the cool thing is, we're already started, we're playing with, and the next thing we're going to talk about is, what is the story about preparation, preparing, like hachana? Is there a need to prepare something before things start? Like, do things need to have a quote-unquote preparation in order for it to be permitted or not on Yom Tov? But what we have right now is, the way it seems to be laid out is it's a question of muksa, no muksa. And nola and muksa go hand in hand, even though that's something, another question, do we split those two out or not? Okay. But for the time being, we're saying is for our purposes, the way it's laid out here is, if you have an egg that's laid on Yom Tov, Beis Shammai says you can eat it because he doesn't hold of any, there's no issue of muksa or nolad. Beis Hillel says you can't because it's a muksa nolad issue and that's not okay. Okay? So that's what we got to so far. And what we've established, at least what it's starting to say here, it seems to be an issue of the context we're talking about is a chicken that is meant for laying eggs as opposed to a chicken that is meant for eating, because then that would be a whole different story, right? If it's meant for eating, that's all, you know, that changes the whole dynamic, which, by the way, just as a little side here, I'll give you a little thing to look at here, and that is... He says here, the Gemara asks, in what manner did you ultimately establish the Mishnah? It is established referring to a chicken designated for laying eggs, and the prohibition is due to muksa. If so, rather than disputing with regard to an egg laid on a festival, let them dispute with regard to the chicken itself. Instead of considering the secondary detail of an egg, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel could discuss whether or not the chicken itself may be slaughtered on a festival. Why are we talking eggs? Let's go to the chicken itself.
So what's the prevailing opinion?
Oh, come on. Seriously?
You're skipping all the fun.
Nah, listen.
No, I'm serious. Like what is considered, like what is done then?
So here's what we have to do. Next time we have to go through the next thing, because the next thing the Gemara is going to do is going to introduce this idea of Hachana de Rabba. Rabba is going to come and say that we're talking about something else. That there's a need for preparation. So we have to go into a subject called Hachana de Rabba, the issue of preparation before a Shabbos and a Yom Tov. Okay.
Right.
And then the question is, there's Rav Nachman's opinion, which is all about muksa, and Rava's issue of preparation. How do we bring those two together? Does one exclude the other? Does one delete or does one negate the other? Or maybe they are two parallel or join things that both go hand in hand. So we have to, like, first we have to go through the Gemara, see how it's, just understand, like, the logic of what it means, Hachana Darabah. Is it a biblical thing? Is it a just a rabbinic thing? Is it something in between? And then once we get there, we'll have to see like how the halacha develops. Like how did the way this works is you take a Gemara, kind of delve into like the opinions that are in the Talmud in the Gemara, and then from there you'll see Rashi, Tosos, and then you know others that are coming from that similar period, how they read the Gemara, how they understood the flow. And then from there, you'll see that it will, you know, as we clarify the definitions of things and the logic of things, that then they extend those ideas into like how we would approach the practice. But what you start to understand is it's so important to start to lay down these the groundwork, because as the cases start to kind of change, like you have curveballs, you have different nuances in different things.
These complexities.
Yeah. So the more that, so like when it came to, like, for example, I'll give you a great example. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who passed away now, I have to look it up on Wiki, but like he lived, he was like the major halach decisor in the between the 1940s and 1980s, with basically throughout the Jewish world, he was the go-to on many things. So you look at his responsa, and you see that he'll answer based on the way the flow of the Talmud is. The same thing goes for example, we went, Hugh, we went to meet Rav Asher Weiss, right? Remember that? Rabbi Weiss? Remember we went to the rabbi, we had like a half hour, not Rav Gamliel, the other rabbi. Do you remember him?
Oh,
did you not go? Did you miss that?
I don't think I went. I missed that one.
Okay, so we went to Rabbi Weiss. So Rabbi Asher Weiss, he's like a major halachic decisor. So in his, like, I I'm not like proficient in his writings, but one of the things that you'll look at his, he'll have a question, and then he'll look at the Talmudic text and how it goes back and forth and develops the idea, and then takes that into extension of how we should rule with a more modern, contemporary question. You know, so understanding the flow of how the Talmudic texts go will be very important. Of course, he'll look at, let's say, how Rambam or the Shulchan Aruch, how the you know how the codifiers, how they understood it, but he might say, you know what, I understood the Talmud flow differently, and therefore my way of, I will apply the halachic decision based on the flow of the Talmud, because that's the ultimate beginning, you know, you start there. So that's...
Well,
so,
it gets down to the letter of the law versus spirit of the law.
No, but you'll see that. It's again, the
halachic... Right. So what's, can you eat the egg or not? What's the opinion?
So right now we're saying that it seems to be, let's see. We'll do a quick, because if we go back here, the beauty of this safaria is
It seems to me that this is one where there might be two different opinions.
I see.
But let's see here.
I'm guessing. I don't know that as a fact.
Here, look at this. So here he says, this is Rambam. Weekdays. Oh, you see, this is a whole other thing. I cannot read this to you. I cannot read this to you until we do more of the Gemara, because it won't make sense to you.
Right.
Okay? We have to, okay? So we'll stop here on
all
this.
Right, very
okay?
Good.